Now for something, as they say, completely different. The inventor of the 5-2 diet, Dr. Michael Mosley, has turned his attention to aging well, and he joins me now. Good afternoon, Michael.
Good afternoon to you. Hi.
Hi. Michael, I suppose we can't avoid aging, but we can do it better. And I know you're making a TV show about so-called super aging. What is super aging?
Yeah, so I think it's going to be called The Secrets of the Super Agers, and it's a six-part series, which I spent last year filming. And the idea is super agers are people who are in their 70s, 80s, sometimes 90s, but who have the sort of mental and physical faculties of someone who is at least 10 years younger, and in some cases 20 or even more years. So they're old, but they don't look old, and they certainly don't, you know, they can function at a very high level.
Okay, so this is not just about living longer, it's about a longer, as we say, health span. Do you fancy yourself as, are you set up to be a super ager, Michael?
I would like to think so. At least I'd like to outdo my grandfather and my father. My grandfather died at 64, my dad died at 74, and no male member of my family has made it beyond 74, and I'm now 65, so I quite fancy at least outdoing my dad.
Yeah.
So if I can extend that, grandfather 64, father 74. If I can make 84 in good shape and then, you know, die windsurfing or skydiving or something like that, I think that's probably kind of how I'd like to go.
I presume that that wouldn't be that difficult. I presume each generation lives longer and has is healthier for longer than the previous generation, right?
Well, live longer, but not necessarily healthier. Until relatively recently, we were putting on about an extra year for every 4 years that went by. So since the 1970s, for example, in Ireland, life expectancy has gone up from something like 70 to about 84. But it flatlined during COVID and indeed fell a bit, certainly in the UK. So more recently, it's flatlined. And unfortunately, the amount of time you spend in ill health has gone up. So although people are living longer, they're not necessarily living healthier.
Okay.
And the average person who's in their 60s can be expected to be on multiple drugs and with some sort of, you know, thing like high blood pressure or high blood sugars or whatever it might be. So, yeah, unfortunately, we're not getting noticeably healthier as we get older.
So has COVID affected, would you say, the health of the herd in general, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, mainly because people started, you know, they were stuck at home, they were getting a bit sad. They were eating far more junk food. The companies that did really well out of COVID were the companies that produced lots of, you know, fizzy drinks, snacks, the ultra-processed food. They saw bumper profits over that period and continue to do so. So people got into the habit as well of getting takeaways, ordering takeaways on apps. So all the signs are certainly in Ireland and in the UK. We've been kind of putting on weight, and particularly kids. Kids have been really very, very sad what's happening to kids in terms of their weight and stuff like that.
Okay, so look, before we get some aging tips, I know that you say you're 64, so you're approaching retirement age yourself. I'm starting to wonder increasingly, is retirement good for us, or does it actually age people more?
It very much depends what they're doing. So if you're doing hard physical labour, then I imagine retirement is kind of good. If you're doing something which is more like what you're doing and what I'm doing, which is sort of writing, talking for a profession, communicating with people, I suspect neither of us have a burning desire to, you know, we might slow down a bit, but I think, you know, you enjoy what you're doing. I love what I'm doing. And it keeps me curious and interested. And I spend my time talking to scientists, making podcasts, writing books, writing articles. And that, I think, kind of keeps me young and interested in the world and constantly, you know, testing myself from that point of view. If you can do that sort of thing, then I think retirement is probably a pretty bad idea. But as I said, if you're somebody who's doing hard physical labor or perhaps a job you hate, then retirement is probably a good thing, or at least, you know, take you up some other interests as well.
Okay. So you've been talking to the experts and examining the science on aging and all this. One key thing I think you've identified is something called the epigenetic clock. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So there's your age, as in what's written on your passport, and then there's what's called your biological age, which is how old you really are. And in recent years, they've developed this new technique which can measure how old you are by measuring something called is basically an epigenetic clock. It's what happens is the DNA, which you have in all your cells, accumulates things called methyl groups, and these basically make the DNA, it's less efficient. Basically, it's not as good at doing the things it used to be able to do before. Bad stuff gets turned on, good stuff gets turned off. So this is a very accurate way of measuring your biological age, and it seems to work across pretty well all animals, including humans. And it gives you a very clear idea of what your biological age is, but also what your life expectancy is based on it. So this is kind of new technology, and we explored it as part of this series I'm making, and I had an epigenetic test. I actually did it with the guy who invented this technology out in the States. And what was quite funny is that I'm about 5 years younger than my, passport age.
Yeah.
And he's about 5 years older. So he's 55. I'm actually 65. And we're both actually 60 biologically, it turns out. So I'm obviously doing some things that are right.
Yeah, so can we get that if we go to the doctor or whatever? Can you get
Though you can, I believe it's going to be commercially available soon. It's called the clock test.
Okay.
And the really interesting thing about it is obviously it kind of gives you bragging rights. But what's really interesting is it then enables scientists to measure other interventions and see whether they work or not.
Oh, so it gives you a baseline to start from, yeah.
You say, hey, do this, eat your veg and you'll live 10 years longer, whatever. But there was no real basis for it. Whereas now with these epigenetic clocks, you can go, okay, I do this, I can see the changes which occur. And they can occur in a relatively short period of time, over a period of 3 or 4 months. And you can go, hey, this is really working for me, or hey, this is not working so well. And that was part of what we're exploring in the series. What sort of things actually accelerate the clock and which things slow it down? And okay, I think that's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah. And before we come to them, I suppose people always want an easy answer. So if we now understand a bit more about aging and DNA and what's happening there and everything, does that mean that we are closer to coming up with some kind of a cure for aging, if you will, or some kind of magic pill?
Absolutely. That's what some of the experts would say. I mean, a lot of them have been funded by the billionaires. So the billionaires are very keen to live longer with all their wealth. And so they're pouring tons of money into this. And you'll not be surprised to hear that a lot of it's going on the West Coast in California. But also, I visited a really interesting lab in Cambridge where they are doing things which seems to reverse the aging of skin cells. At
like
least.
What?
Down to skin yet, but they've managed to knock 10 years off the skin age. And they think that you could, for example, take a sample of skin from someone. You could reverse the age by 10, 20 years. You could grow it to get a great big sheet of your own skin, and then you get slapped on. Probably not initially for cosmetic reasons, but more, say, you have burns. So if you have a burn, you'd want some nice, fresh skin put on rather than some old, wrinkly skin. And they say that's probably possible within the next decade or, say, maybe in the next 5 years or so, if you're optimistic.
Okay, but look, these things always do come down to kind of making a bit of an effort in the current world we live in until all that comes on stream. So in terms of simple lifestyle changes that can help us to age better, now your new book is called Just One Thing, and it's a very appealing suggestion that we make small, simple changes and even try one of them or a bunch of them, yeah?
Absolutely.
So,
and I'm pleased to say that also there is good evidence that certainly combinations of them can reverse your epigenetic change. So this is very new stuff, but yeah. And they're really quite easy. And the idea is the idea of the book, and it's based on a podcast series I do for the BBC called Just One Thing, is that they're very achievable. And although some of them require a bit of effort, some of them really don't require much effort at all. They're just swapping things.
Okay, so if we start with, you have kind of 10 rules there. Keep it simple is rule number one, which I think is always key to everything, really, isn't it? And what are the other rules we should know before we embark on changing things?
So I think keep it simple, commit to it. Ideally, do it with someone else, or at least tell your loved one or your family that you are doing it and encourage them to join you in it. I've got 30 things in the Just One Thing book, and I spread them out across the day. I do pretty well all of them, but I wouldn't advise you to start on all of them. I'd just skim the book, see which ones you fancy, which you would like to try, give them a go, try and stick to them, for at least, you know, a month, preferably longer. And that means they're more likely to stick. And try to link them to something you are already doing. That seems to be key to habits. So, for example, in the book, I describe the fact that I do what I call intelligent exercises first thing in the morning. These are mainly squat up, press ups and squats. But I do them first thing because I know that I have to get out of bed. And so I'm linking the activity, get out of bed, with doing the press-ups and squats. I do them with my wife because then we can encourage each other when we don't really want to do them. It's about linking it because I know if I don't do them then, I just will never do them. Whereas other people I know, they do them while they're waiting for a cup of coffee. They might do a few squats. And the reason I'm a big fan of press-ups and squats is they work the biggest muscles in your body. And also this research, which was done at the University of South Wales, which showed that when you do that vertical movement, say with a squat or indeed with a press up, you get a big surge of blood to your brain. And this actually leads to production of a hormone called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And this stuff is like fertilizer for the brain. So it appears that when you do these particular activities, much more so than, say, running, you get this big surge of BDNF, which, as I said, seems to be really good for preserving your brain cells. And that's why I call it intelligent exercises. And it only takes a couple of minutes.
How many do you do?
Get out of bed, just do them. And you don't have to think about it. And you can build up over time. Start gently, build up.
Okay, how many do you do?
And also really good for your spine, particularly press-ups. I recently had a DEXA scan, x-ray thing done of my spine, and I got the spine of a 30-year-old. I'm 65, so I'll take that.
Oh, stop boasting. So boast again. How many press-ups and squats are you doing in the morning?
I do about 30 of both. I break it up a bit. I sometimes do other things as well. You know, I started off doing like 5, and then over time I've just accumulated them. And that's kind of, I sort of pretty much stopped there, but that seems to be enough to do, you know, keep my thighs in good shape and my spine in good shape and my torso in good shape. So, and as I said, it takes a maximum of about 2 minutes.
Okay. So is 30, is that what people should be aiming for? If people who might not have the spine of a 2-year-old.
There was a study where done a few years ago in the States where it was actually with, I think it was police officers. And they took a bunch of them who were then in their late 30s. And they asked them, how many press-ups can you do in a minute? And then they, you know, measured them. And then they came back 20 years later and they found the ones who could do more than 30 or 30 or more were twice as likely to still be alive as those who couldn't, because they had much less rates of heart disease, cancer, all sorts of things. So we know these things are good for your brain, but they're also really good for your body and they're good for your spine. And the thing I guess I think is important and why I write about it in the book is it's based on science. You've got to be convinced. You've got to be convinced by what I tell you, by what the scientists tell you. Otherwise, you're not going to bother to do it. If I can really, really convince you that press-ups and squats are probably the best 2 exercises you can do, then maybe you'll do them. Even when it's a bit painful in the morning and you're thinking, why am I doing this? You might think to yourself, well, I've read that chapter. I've read the science. I'm convinced. I'll keep going. And as I said, don't try and do huge amounts initially and do go and look online to see how to do them properly, because it's very easy not to do them properly. And you can sort of injure yourself if you start doing exercises if you don't do them the right way.
Okay, but there's one thing that we could all take away from today, so is try start that. Talk me through the rest of your day then. If you're doing the whole 30 of them, what else do you do in the morning?
Sure. So I'm having a cold shower most mornings.
How many minutes?
I do that. I turn on the hot water, get in, wash myself, and then I have a blast of cold water.
For how long?
Probably about 30 or 40 seconds. There is some good evidence about benefits for your immune system and also for mood from doing that. Again, it's one of those things, give it a go. If you absolutely hate it, don't do it. But start with 10 seconds. See if you can bear 10 seconds and then build up from there. You don't have to do a minute, 30 to 40 seconds. Okay. That's what the studies show seems to be sufficient.
Okay, go on.
And I sing in the choir, in the shower. My wife stands there stoically while the water runs off her. I sing because I find it distracts me, but also because there is a load of research showing the benefits of singing. A few years ago, I took part in a study where we were measuring something called endocannabinoids, which are a kind of cannabis-like substance that your body naturally produces. And we found that when people were singing, they were enjoying it, particularly if they're in something like a choir, then that really boosted their levels of endocannabinoids. That seemed to explain the feel-good feeling you get. It's better when you're doing it with other people, but frankly, singing in the shower is also fine.
Yeah, I read somewhere that when special forces guys are like, say, running up a hill with a load of kit on and it's lashing rain, it's really cold and everything, they sing because it actually fools their mind that they're having a good time.
Absolutely. And they're probably getting a good old boost of these endocannabinoids, which do multiple things, including dampening down pain, as well as giving you a sort of feel-good factor. So again, in the book, loads of research.
Okay.
On the benefits of singing, not just for mood, but pain and all sorts of things as well. So,
okay, next.
A really fascinating area.
Next.
Next is basically I go for an early morning walk if I can find the time. Benefits of going early morning walk, take the dog. Dog loves it. You get a good old blast of early morning light. Sorry, I'm about to cough. Not very healthy.
Michael, that's ruined everything now. You were doing so well, and now people are thinking, oh, listen to that. Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, all of us are fallible. it's winter. I probably got some bug. It happens. So early morning walk, bright light, resets your internal clock, sets you up for the day. If you can fit that in, that's great. And then it's kind of breakfast time. So okay. I tend to... I'm sort of pursuing a sort of what I call intermittent fasting. I try to delay breakfast a bit, and then I bring my evening meal forward. It's something called time-restricted eating, and
yeah.
It's something I've written
What's
about.
What's your interval? Years.
There's benefits for, again, a bit of weight loss, but also multiple other benefits, particularly if you kind of can bring your evening meal a bit forward. That seems to be...
So what time for breakfast and what time to stop eating?
Bed, that seems to be a good idea.
Okay,
again,
what time do you have your breakfast?
All the detail on that.
Yeah, what time do you have your breakfast and what time do you finish eating?
Probably I have my breakfast about 8:30, something like that. I get up quite early and I try to finish eating by 8. So it's a kind of 12-hour overnight fast. Some people go more hardcore. There's a thing called 14-10, or people actually do 16-8, where they do 16 hours. But I find 12 hours is kind of sufficient for me, I think. So I basically am trying to aim not to eat between about 8 p.m. and 8 a.m. And you don't do that every day, because obviously you're going to go out and have a bit of a evening sometimes. But as a general rule, that's what I'm aiming for.
Okay. Coffee with breakfast?
Yeah, with breakfast, again, I lots of benefits to coffee, love coffee, 4 or 5 cups, indeed 3 or 4 cups are probably optimal, somewhere around there. Loads of studies show the benefits of coffee for mood, reaction times, things like that. Not for everyone, but it can raise your blood pressure, but most people kind of get benefit from a good old cup of coffee. But the thing that surprised me was when I was talking to the expert, he said, try to avoid having it within 90 minutes of waking. And he said that's because when you wake up, you've got this big surge of the stress hormone cortisol, which is kind of getting you out of bed, getting you going. And if you have a cup of coffee straight away, then basically you're just ramping up things like your blood pressure and your stress levels. So it's best to wait for about 90 minutes, maybe with your breakfast if you're having your later breakfast, you know, maybe even a bit later. And you kind of hit your body and your brain with it when these cortisol levels are falling. And that happens about 90 minutes after you wake.
Okay. Listen, no, time is not on our side here, so we're not going to get through the whole rest of the day.
Quite a list.
Give me a few highlights from the rest of the day that people might try.
Well, obviously, things which are easier and nicer might be, for example, having a nap in the afternoon. 20 minutes nap is very good for you, 20, 25 minutes. Try to have it in the early afternoon. Lots of benefits to that. Dark chocolate, if you can switch from eating milky chocolate and other sort of, you know, sugary snacks. Dark chocolate, you know, 60-70% cocoa seems to be good for your blood pressure, for your gut bacteria, stuff like that. Turns out, surprisingly, playing video games is good for your brain. Who knew?
Yeah.
I've been discouraging my kids all the time, and it turns out, no, I've started playing video games with them. Though, to be honest, they're so much better than I am. Those are just a few things. And dancing, you know, take up a bit of dancing.
Bit of dancing, yeah. Okay. Listen, I was heartened actually on the chocolate thing to see you writing recently that you actually struggled with a sweet tooth, and that with all your science and everything, the way you deal with it in your house is your wife Claire hides the junk food basically.
That's the one. We try not to have the junk food. But fortunately for me, Claire, the kids have all left home. Claire doesn't have a sweet tooth. She just naturally seems to like healthy stuff. But when stuff is in home, when people, you know, give us chocolates for presents or things like that, then I hand them over to Claire and she doles them out. She hides them in, and sometimes I find them and sometimes I eat a couple before I hand them back to her. Sometimes if I know they're there, then it starts to prey on my mind. And I'll go hunting them. So, yeah, I have a terrible weakness for chocolate. Yeah. And eating dark chocolate is kind of better. But if there's any milk chocolate in the house, I will root it out and eat it.
Okay. And you say any advice around sleep as well?
Absolutely. So I've written a book called Faster Sleep, which is, because I'm not a great sleeper, I'm a sort of 3 a.m. wake up, think about stuff. And the best of, there is loads of the sort of practical stuff, you know, dark room and things like that. Wearing an eye mask, one of my sleep experts said was a real game changer for her. Because it's cold now, I'm wearing socks in bed, which I find also helps. In the book, we look at having a hot shower in the evening. If you have that about an hour before you go to bed, then that raises your temperature initially and then drops it. And dropping temperature seems to be good for triggering sleep.
Okay.
And the main thing is when you wake at 3 a.m, try doing these sort of breathing exercises again, which I describe in the book, which are 4-2-4. Another variance, you just breathe in through your nose to count of 4, hold it for 2, breathe out to 4. You do this kind of, try and do it for a minute or two, and everything slows down. Your heart rate slows down. You feel much, you know, quieter and gentler, and it's a great way of going back to sleep.
Yeah, and you're distracting yourself from the thoughts as well, obviously. One last question for you, Michael. Pat here, who's 59, text says, if you can do a press-up, you're already fit. What about a lot of us who couldn't even do one and get sore wrists if we try?
Absolutely. The thing is, start on your knees. So don't do a full press-up, just on your knees and try and do a gentle press-up like that, or indeed even simpler, just against the wall. So you stick your feet about, you know, half a meter out from the wall, lean into the wall and push back again, and do that a few times. Ideally, what you're trying to do is, with these things, is go to exhaustion is what the rule is. Whatever it's doing, even if it's, if you can do 2 and you're exhausted and can't do any more, then that's absolutely fine. And you just kind of build up from there. But have a look online, and there's lots of advice, you know, whether it is, you know, NHS websites, whatever, on how to do these things properly and how to start up. So, yeah, even if you can't do one, try a kneeling one, try a wall one, anything is better than nothing.
Dr. Michael Mosley, always so fantastically useful. Thank you very much. And Just One Thing is published by Short Books and it's out now. Talk to you soon, Michael. Thank you. We'll take a break.
Yeah, pleasure.
Email brendan@rte.ie.